that's my first general thought. And, you know, I think it's really excited to see what can happen when we get such an exciting group of people together to brainstorm ideas. And I think it's a really exciting time for science. Actually, one of the exciting ideas that already emerged was Shimek Pustelny had this idea that maybe we should go around the room and introduce ourselves, since I think there's so many people from so many, as Maxime was pointing out, from so many different sort of groups. So maybe if everybody could go around, everybody could say, introduce themselves and just say, this might kill the other hour, but just maybe a brief sentence about, you know, what their background is and where they're from. That'd be awesome. So I guess you know about it.
I'm Maxim Paspalov, and I work here in Victoria, and I'm a particle theorist, but on sort of good days, on bad days, like today, I'm just behaving with light fields, and I'm interested in all the precision tests of the Steiner model and cosmology.
So my name is Minar Hamitaki. I just moved here, the perimeter. I was at Stanford before, and I'm also a particle theorist that is interested in similar ideas as Maxim. So we come up with crazy experiments.
I'm Dmitry Butker at the Helmholtz Institute of Mines at UC Berkeley, and I guess the most important thing about my background is that I was a PhD thesis advisor for about four speakers in this meeting.
I'm Valerio Faroni from Bishop University in Quebec, close to here, and I work mostly in alternative fields of gravity and cosmology.
Yeah, I'm Michael Kozlov from St. Petersburg, and I'm doing atomic theory in application to variation of constants and fundamental symmetries.
I'm Vladimir Dzubov from the University of New South Wales in Sydney, Australia. I mostly do atomic calculations on a very similar subject, variation of fundamental constants, parity and time invariance correlation, similar topics.
I'm Evgeny Stadnik, also from University of New South Wales, and I look at atomic and molecular theory and applications.
I'm Guglielmo Pino from Florence University, Firenze. And I'm doing experiments with atoms, testing fundamental physics, and recently mostly gravity.
So I'm Chris Pankow, I'm a postdoc at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. I come from gravitational wave searches such as LIGO, and I do data analysis and searches for transient signals.
I'm Gordon Kanyaich. I'm here, a particle theorist, and I work on dark matter, BSN physics, and light degrees of freedom.
I'm Michael Ramalis, I'm at Princeton University, I'm an experimentalist working with spins, polarized atoms, magnetometers, and precision measurements of various kinds.
I'm Nathan Weaver. I'm at the Helmholtz Institute of Mines, and my background is atomic physics, looking for variation of alpha and Tesla Lorentz energy.
I'm Shimon Kusel, and I'm responsible for all this, this part at least. I'm from Jagiellonian University in Krakow, Poland. I work on magnetometry, and I'm an experimentalist, and yeah, I'm one of the former graduate students of here.
I'm Jeremy Martin. I'm a postdoc at Stanford, and I do particle theory, and right now I'm very interested in weird dark matter.
I'm Sudhir Dattigran. I'm currently at Stanford, and I'm starting a job at Berkeley in about a couple of weeks. I'm a particle theorist, and I'm interested in coming up with new ways to probe fundamental physics.
I'm Peter Graham. I'm a particle theorist at Stanford, and similar to these other particle theorists, I'm willing to think of non-traditional things.
Andrew Dracy, an experimentalist at the University of Nevada, and we're doing experiments on short-range force detection using AMO technique.
Eli Levitsy-Falk, I'm a postdoc at Stanford working with Aaron Kapitulnik on short-range gravity detection and other fundamental force detection.
Jason Hogan, I'm at Stanford University, experimentalist in atomic physics, work with atom interferometry for tests of gravity and gravitational wave detection.
Blaine Heckel, University of Washington. We do torsion balance tests of gravity. I'm also involved in some electric dipole moment measurements to test CP violation.
I'm Eckhard Peik. I'm from PDB. It's Germany's Metrology Institute, and I'm an experimentalist working on atomic bombs.
I'm Lutz Franz, also from PTB. And I'm not a particle physicist, I'm not a cosmologist, but for some reason I've done a few experiments during the last few years with precision measurements of spin precession in very low magnetic fields.
My name is Justin Jeet. I'm a graduate student from the University of California, Los Angeles. I work for Eric Hudson, experimentalist in AMO physics, and we're looking for the thorium-229 nuclear transition.
I'm Duncan O'Dell. I work at McMaster University, which is about an hour away from Waterloo, and I'm a theorist in AMO. I'm interested in interferometry, particularly measuring gravity and things like that.
I'm Joseph Bradler. I was a postdoc at Johns Hopkins, and now I'm just in the process of moving to the Institute of High Energy Physics in Vienna. I'm a particle theorist. I work a lot on dark matter and on astrophysical aspects of light diffusion.
My name is Jason Stoniker. I'm at Oberlin College, and I'm an experimentalist to work on precision measurements, precision spectroscopy using optical instruments.
Jim Sherman at NIST, the NIST Metrology Lab. Work on trapped atoms and ions, so cold, bright matter, and atomic clocks.
I'm Gidro Chapuri from the University of Tokyo, and we have, I'm working on precision measurement, especially working on optical rapiscope.
I'm Raman Sundram. I'm a particle theorist by day. I work on dark energy by night. But my days would be more productive.
I am a theorist from my University of Nevada, Reno. So, and Reno is a Berkeley of Nevada. I work on passive fundamental symmetries with atomic systems and also on atomic clocks.
Hi, I'm Philip Schuster. I'm here at PI. I'm principally a theorist. I like to think about anything and everything that can help me understand why the standard model works the way that it does and what we might be missing and what kinds of experiments would be interesting to find new physics.
Natalia Toro, also a particle physics faculty here at PI. I mostly do theory. I'm interested in some, I've been working on some new experiments at what you guys consider very high energies, although usually to my particle physics colleagues I call it a GeV low energy. And also very interested in thinking about long distance velocity dependent conformations of force laws.
Peter Kalchuk, National Physical Laboratory in London, actually didn't that close to London, experimentalist frequency standards magnetometry.
I'm Haifeng An, particle theorist. I'm a postdoc here at PI. I'm working mostly on dark matter and kinetic physics.
I'm Mark Kimienkowski from Johns Hopkins University. I'm a cosmologist.
Great. Well, thank you, everybody. And yeah, thanks for being here.
So our experimental colleagues may think that you know, particle theorists just ran out of job, right? But that's a separate, you know, special subset of people.
So I guess I should introduce myself. So my name is Derek Kimball, and I'm from California State University East Bay, which is located equidistantly between Berkeley and Stanford. So you know, we're at the epicenter right there. So we're all there. Things come. So in terms of some origins, I was going to tell a little history of how did I. So I'm. Oh, I should say too. What I do. So I'm an experimentalist. That's you know, for some reason, also like many of you, but I don't know exactly how it happened. But I became you know, extremely interested and passionate about these kind of precision measurements to look for new physics and atomic systems. And at least I can tell a little bit of that history. So these are two folks who are sort of, I regard as both my heroes and kind of experimental grandfathers. So Mac Zolotrev and Eugene Cummins, and they have one of their contributions is they made one of the first measurements of parity, atomic parity violation in atoms, which was really the first evidence for the neutral weak current violating parity. And at the time, it was a very exciting time because there'd been a couple of previous measurements that had found that there was no atomic parity violation due to the neutral weak interaction. And then, you know, it's one of my favorite, I just have to throw this up there, it's one of my all-time favorite graphs from a paper
where, you know, it's experiment divided by theory, and you've got 0, 0, 1, you know, it was pretty exciting. It turns out later that was maybe need to be corrected and be 0, 0, 2, which is a problem. But then actually, so this was from Max and Barkov's paper in 1978, and actually Gene Cummins' group published a paper that actually, so I guess really the next plot was 0, 0, 2, 1. Finally, you know, it settled down there after that. And so there, that was the first observation. Professor Cummins was telling me that, you know, it was a very exciting time because the standard model had been predicted. There'd been evidence of scattering of neutrinos through the neutral weak interaction, but there hadn't yet been evidence of parity violation. And when these measurements came out, they were convening conferences like this one where they were discussing, you know, all right, so the neutral weak interaction doesn't violate parity, it looks like. So we got to go back to the drawing board. The standard model is going down. You know, it was a pretty exciting time. And then these measurements came out, and then maybe the standard model is okay. And of course, we know the history from there. So, I thought maybe this would be a motivational slide, because even though we keep measuring zero all the time, you know, there was once a time when people were measuring zero, and then all of a sudden they didn't measure zero. So don't give up. There's still hope. These two heroes of mine also have the distinction of being the both advisors of our very own Dmitry Butkir here. And that's where I come into the picture, because I was one of these many students of Dima's that are here at the conference. So I guess it was actually 18 years ago, I think. You know, I had no idea, you know, as I was an undergraduate student, I had no idea that there existed such a field as, you know, measuring, doing precision measurements with atomic physics. And, you know, when I joined school, I had, you know, I didn't know anything. I thought, you know, maybe I'd be a particle experimentalist or something like that. But then, you know, I kind of found out what particle experimentalists did on a day-to-day basis, and it didn't seem as exciting to me anymore. And then I wandered into Dima's office one day, actually with Jason, and I knew when I wandered in with Jason, he was so brilliant that, well, I guess I'd probably have to get a different job. But then it turned out that Dima, you know, even though there's only one position, he hired two people to fill one spot. So then, you know, so 18 years later, I still think it's just the most exciting thing to work on these kind of experiments, and it's very exciting. So there was a story. I was trying to get the story right, so I was asking Dima about it, but he doesn't remember this story. So there's a story that Max told me, and so I think something that's really exciting, obviously, about this conference is that we're getting this interface between theory and experiment, and you know, of course, you can write some equations down, and now this is the chance for those equations to lead to some sort of, you know, equipment. And the story that I was told, I think it was Professor Kriplovich, who was a theory professor at Novosibirsk.
It was Maxim's advisor, by the way.
Oh, no food. Okay. Well, maybe you know the story better, because Max told me. So I think this was Kriplovich and Barkov, I think. So Kriplovich had an idea, some theory idea, and made some calculation, and he was got excited, and he told Barkov about it, and Barkov got excited, and so he went and started building stuff, right, and he was working on it. And then Kriplovich found, I don't know, a sign error or something was wrong, came back, like, oh, I made a mistake in this calculation, and Barkov was so mad, he goes down, takes his experiment up fast and puts it on a cart and wheels it down, and then into Kriplovich's office, and then he puts it on his desk. He's like, this is what happens when you get a minus sign wrong. And so then Kriplovich, at least this is a story I told you, took it and put it up on a shelf to remind him to be very careful next time, because it had consequences. But... so that's, yeah, that's the exciting thing, I think, about it, getting us together. And So then I should keep it even. So this is a story actually from Gene Cummins that he was telling. He's like, so Gene was born in the year 1932, and he said, you know, in 1932, James Chadwick discovered the neutron. And he said, you know, you should go back and look at that paper. It's so elegant, so simple, so beautifully written. And if you look at what he did, he built an experimental apparatus for about $5, and he did the experiment by himself, and he discovered the neutron. Right. And this is an experimental diagram from that paper, right? And then, you know, and he says, if you think about it, you know, and that was the year that Professor Cummins was born. And then, you know, like the equivalent discovery today would be the CERN team that discovered the Higgs, which were thousands of people for billions of dollars. And in Professor Cummins' estimate, at least, he's like, maybe the neutron was even a little more important than the Higgs, you know, in the scale of particles. And he's like, you know, he's like, he's like, you know, this has happened in my own lifetime. And he's like, I don't know if this is sustainable. So, of course, you know, Professor Cummins had on many occasions counseled me to maybe think of some other field, but, you know, I'm undeterred. So, you know, so I think, I mean, that's another exciting thing about this conference. That I think, you know, this is an opportunity to try to maybe think of some creative ideas that might get us a little closer back to Chadwick's kind of approach to particle physics than the modern approach. You know, and another thing, you know, I think just to echo, I think Maxime's comments, which were, of course, of a much more advanced nature, but, you know, I think from my experimentalist standpoint, I have this kind of feeling that the present state of particle physics is that, you know, so the standard model was a theory with lots and lots of experimental evidence to back it up. So when, you know, there's this missing piece of the standard model, which is the Higgs, well, everything fit together like a nice, you know, spider web. And you know, the shocking thing would have been if the Higgs wasn't there and it was there and okay, that's all fine and good. But now, you know, it's kind of that last piece of the puzzle has been fit. So it feels like, you know, what the next physics is very speculative. You know, I don't think there's no, at least in my estimate, any theoretical prediction that already has some experimental evidence behind it to tell us where to go next. So I think that's why, you know, I think it's extremely exciting. I always try to tell my students because they're often confused. And it's like, that's a, you know, don't get depressed. That's an exciting time, you know, because, you know, imagine a life where there's no confusion. I mean, you wouldn't learn anything, you know. This, you know, every time you're confused, that's an opportunity to discover something and learn something. So I think that's exactly where we are at, both in theory and experiment, when we're testing fundamental physics, is it's not totally clear what the next thing is going to be, and so it's a good time to cast our net widely and be creative. And of course, there, you know, even though there's, at least in my humble estimate, there's no particularly strong motivation for one theory over another, but I'm sure people will disagree with that. We have a lot of great mysteries in physics right now, so those do point the way, at least to some degree, of where to look. We have the missing CP violation to describe baryogenesis. There's the strong CP problem. There's dark matter. There's dark energy. You know, the size of the proton. There's a lot of interesting mysteries out there that people are trying to understand and don't quite completely fit in with known physics. So, you know, I think you know, that's another kind of big thing that I think we can all get around together is to think about how the new physics interfaces with all these great mysteries and what ways we can search to look for it. You know, and in a certain sense, from kind of the big picture of the experimental viewpoint, you know, it feels also like there's, you know, we have at least a kind of a finite set of parameters to work with, you know, when you go get right down to it. So these elementary matter particles, right, they only have a few properties to them. I mean, they have some monopole moments, charge and mass and things like that. They have some spin and not much else. They can move relative to one another. And, you know, so there's, you know, so at least that, you know, limits the kind of the parameter space of things you can do in the laboratory to some degree. And, you know, even if you go to, you know, quantum field theory, if you want to go there with some general assumptions, you know, it only seems to allow some sort of finite number of possible potentials if you have spin one, spin zero, and spin one. And as we were discussing last night over drinks, it seems like higher spin particles are hard to imagine, but it seems like there's you know, a finite parameter space of things to look for. So, you know, I think, you know, as I guess Feynman once said, the you know, physics is amazingly creative, but you're kind of in a straitjacket. And I think that's of reality and nature and things like that. So I think you know, that's the you know, it's a creative time, but a time with these constraints on it to figure out how we can look for it. So, you know, as Maxime already mentioned, you know, I think one of the new directions, and hopefully, you know, this conference will generate even more new directions in these low energy tests of fundamental physics that has kind of emerged just in the last couple of years is, you know, as Maxime was pointing out, so there's been a long history of searching for local signatures, for example, like these electric dipole moment searches, which have gone on since Ramsey's experiment in the 50s, right, where you're modulating something in your system and you're looking for some anomalous spin-dependent interaction, and you're seeing some periodic signature based on something local you're varying in the laboratory, which could be a mass source or a spin source or electric field or whatever we can control.
And then furthermore, of course, we've looked for some sort of constant background signals. And I think you can look for maybe some variations of that, maybe as the Earth is moving through these constant background signatures. But that's also something that has had some long history. But I think recently, and another thing, of course, is Dima and Max has taught me is that, of course, maybe these new ideas were actually not only previously discovered and discussed and thought of some time ago, but even before that, it was discussed and discovered by Russians. I don't know how new it is exactly, but it seems at least that this idea now of using these same kind of atomic systems and low energy measurements to look for transient signals that might have some origin in some astrophysical phenomena, that seems to be kind of a new emerging thing. And right now, there's been a lot of papers and ideas. Yeah.
So how do you know your parity violation plot wasn't a transient signal?
Yeah, which is a perfect point. But right, and the only thing stopping us is being able to set up one of these parity violation experiments to run 24/7, for some, years to monitor these transmits.
And also, we have a neutron lifetime, which has been a period.
That too, yeah.
It's tough to separate the two, the real physics from the.
Yeah, no, which I think Andre wrote a great, was it an essay, blog post? We're not sure what it was, but it was, I think making this a, exact point that it come up in these discussions is that, just the way that we do experiments, right, where we, work for 10 years to get everything working, and then finally, at the last second, it's finally working, we take data for a couple of days, and then, we publish our result, and that's the efforts of our 10 or 20 years or whatever, building up our experiment. But then, on the basis of the most simple assumption, we assume, okay, that experiment is as measured, some constant of some property that's universal or something like that. But if that's not the case, we can easily miss it, right? At a a level of sensitivity that's probably much worse than what the measurement sensitivity is reported to be. Yeah, that's totally right. So it's a good point. Maybe Max's factor of two wasn't passed through some dark matter. So I think that's exciting, and hopefully with all the creative minds here, there's other things you can think of. And right, so then the question becomes, where to search, how to search, and what to search for. And as the experimentalist, I think that's really where the theorists come in and really help by providing not only the motivation, like what is the best place to look, but also what are the connections between the different measurements. I think a great example of that is the standard model extension that has been developed where, for a long time, people were doing these local Lorentz invariance tests. And Alan Kostolexky and co-workers kind of worked out this sort of generalized field theory that allowed, if you do a measurement in dysprosium and limit local Lorentz invariance violation, you do a measurement in mercury or cesium or potassium and these other systems or helium, how do those different measurements constrain similar and related parameters? And that's a huge contribution, I think, to help the experimentalists know where to look. Because, one of the most important things is, if we go back to my very simple slide, it's a very important thing to know, what is the region that hasn't been explored where dragons might still exist, and what a region hasn't been explored that you should probably, in your finite lifetime with finite resources, you should probably move on and look somewhere else. So that's a huge, important thing to figure out. So, originally, when we started discussing this meeting, it kind of came out, and we were trying to debate about the origins of this, which is, I think, a great example for the kind of thing that can happen in this meeting. So Shimmick and Dima and I and some others had been discussing for some time this idea of this global network of magnetometers to look for transient signals. And basically, the original idea was that, okay, we've got these sensitive magnetometers, and we can hook them up through the GPS system to track it at time. And I'd just gotten out of listening to a bunch of LIGO talks, and I thought, oh yeah, that would be perfect. You can correlate these signals and look for bursts, and that's a great way to kind of distinguish between some sort of random noise in your system and some transient signal that might be of some interesting physics. But and we even wrote up some proposals for this, but in our motivation section of our proposals, we had this, what we said was like, all right, so we've got these sensitive, magnetometers, and we can put them, and we're going to look for some crazy physics coming from outer space, and it'll be very exciting. And But of course, when the funding agency reads that, you know, and we say, well, nobody's ever really looked for this before, and but we didn't have any parameter space plots, we couldn't, you know, relate it, and there's no theoretical motivation for what we're looking for, so that was very hard to convince anybody to do it. And then, you know, luckily with all of Dima's contacts all over the world, people would come to his office every week, and every time he'd ask me, hey, we've got this great idea of all these crazy, these magnetometers connected, what can we look for? And finally, Maxime was the winner who came through the office and said, I've got an idea.
Dima, I should say, he has persistence, right? So once I was asked, right? And once I was visiting, he took me for dinner with wine, right?
So that's another strategy for this meeting, is we have to take people out with some wine, finally. Yeah, so there was this idea that you know, and it was something as an experimentalist I'd never heard of before, this idea of these domain walls. But I was like, wow, that sounds really out there. But then you look it up on Google Scholar, and there's like 4,000 papers on this subject. And I'm like, wow, man, there's so much. There's probably so many subjects with 4,000 papers on it that I've never even heard of. It's fantastic. So that's this idea of this GNOME project is, and so originally part of the idea was, you know, we're actually starting to build it now. And now is the opportunity to try to think of other things you might look for. I don't want to limit us just to only looking for domain walls, you know, because I hear from these LIGO presentations that all over the universe there's, you know, black holes are running into each other all over the place, and, you know, fantastic energies. Who knows what those could be creating? And maybe we can detect some of that crazy stuff that we don't know what it's detecting. And so, you know, now's the time to set the parameters of our system and see where what parameter space we can search. So that's part of the excitement. But, you know, but this was just the tip of the iceberg with some of these ideas, right? So now there's this new cosmic axion spin precession experiment. Casper will hear a talk about that later. And so that's another idea that kind of came out of this. And then we've got this network of atomic clocks. I guess it means an acronym too. NACL, I don't know. We'll work on it. You know, it's very exciting. You know, it's, you know, kind of going along these same ideas, and just as you were saying, you know, there can be astrophysically induced perioviolating effects. There are some transient signal in that domain. And you know, so I think, you know, just kind of to broadly set the tone, you know, I think really you can think of basically transient violations of any physical laws. I mean, as an experimentalist, I don't know what I'm talking about. So, you know, it seems possible that, you know, and I think as Andre pointed out, like these could have evaded detection quite easily because you do your test for a few days and if it happened, you know, once in a long while, you'll miss it. And we're kind of trained actually to ignore these kind of transient events that we average out or discard from our data that's 10 sigma away from everything else. But of course, you know, given the difficulty of these experiments and our finite resources, and you know, it's really important to think about maybe what are the most promising areas to test, and that's where we come together. And what's the most promising systems with which to perform these tests? So these are a few of the general questions that, you know, hopefully we can stimulate discussions about. And I'm just tremendously excited to see what comes out of it. So I guess without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Dima.
Where does this connect from?
I don't know. I don't really know this one.
Yeah. Okay. So thank you so much, Maxime.
Can you please put your microphone on?
It's the voice of God.
The voice of God.
The voice of God. Yeah.
I always thought I just. I always thought that the voice of God should sound like that. Anyway, is it on now? Okay, let's assume that. So I would like to thank Maxim, Asimina, and all of the other organizers because this meeting basically has barely started, but it's already been one of the most exciting meetings in my life. I would also like to thank the previous two speakers for setting up the tone, the general tone of the meeting, and also eating up all my time, essentially. So I'm going to bring us down one level to the trenches. And so you can see the themes here on these pictures is like day and night, and also matter and antimatter will come in further on. So actually, originally this meeting was sort of thought of like a gnome brainstorming meeting, but it gradually expanded into other themes, and I was asked to compile a list of open questions. And when I did this on the plane, I realized that actually most of my open questions are quite away from these original themes, but they were motivated. But in the end, I'll have some of the questions asked as well. A lot of the things I would like to bring up to this discussion has to do with gravity somehow. And let's just move on along this list. So I don't need to tell you that the main mechanism for atomic parity violation comes from the interaction from the interference between the electromagnetic interaction described by this diagram and the Z exchange. And T even and P odd correlation that corresponds to this interaction is sigma dot p, where sigma is the spin of the electron and p is its momentum. And I would like to ask you to remember this, because we'll come back to this in just a little bit. I have to tell you just a couple of words about the one of the systems that we like to work with. It's atomic dysprosium. And as you know, the parity violation effects, they scale very rapidly with the atomic number, like Z cube, roughly, or even maybe faster. And also, they are enhanced if you have opposite parity levels that are close together, just because of the energy denominator enhancement. And so dysprosium, in fact, was one of the atoms that was pointed out by Professor Hriplovich and his colleague in their seminal 1986 paper as a good object to do parity violation. There are also other reasons, many stable isotopes, both even and odd for studying the neutron number dependence of parity violation and the Annapol effect, the nuclear spin dependent parity violation. And in this particular system, what you have is two levels that whose energy difference can be made zero. It's very small to start with, but then you can apply external fields and bring the levels to the crossing. And so there is a particular type of experiment you do to measure parity violation that is quite different from other atomic experiments. Anyway, long story short, we did this experiment first in 97, and that was done with Max Zolotaryov, Dave DeMille, my colleague for many years, and Tuan Nguyen, who was my actually first graduate student. And we did this experiment in dysprosium, and we found the result was on the one hand very rewarding, because our sensitivity to the weak matrix element was everything we ever promised. It was very good, just a few hertz. It was much better than the sensitivity, for example, of the cesium parity violation experiment. But the number itself was very disappointing, which was zero, basically. And at that time, the theoretical expectations were quite a bit larger. So I think it's understood now, you know, that it should be, in fact, quite small. And Volodya can tell much more about this. But I would like to say that, as we will hear from Volodya's talk later, I believe that this very zero number may turn out to be quite significant after all. And that's, I'm just setting this up here for that. So this is the energy level of dysprosium, the energy levels that are relevant. Only a few of many levels are drawn. So these are the two nearly degenerate levels. If you look at, you know, closely, the separation here is different for different isotopes and hyperfine structure components, and it's from megahertz to gigahertz, which is very small. And like I said, if you want, you can even make these levels completely degenerate. And at that time, you know, sort of at the end of 1990s, when the parity experiment provided zero result, we were thinking what to do next. We were, of course, trying to think of ways to improve the sensitivity of the parity measurement. But at that time, Victor Flambaum started to work on us to convince us that this is, in fact, a very good system for other type of experiments, and in particular, alpha variation search. And so this is, in fact, the paper where Volodya was the first author, where the sensitivity to alpha variation was suggested. And we sort of retooled that parity violation experiment into an alpha dot experiment, and had several generations of this experiment. And if you look at the sensitivity with the present apparatus, you see that, you know, it's pretty good. So it can get you to the range of 10 to minus 18 for the alpha dot over alpha over the years. And, you know, because you're working with nearly degenerate levels, delta nu over nu, the parameter that is important for atomic clocks, is very modest. It's only 10 to minus 11 for these numbers over there. And so you can actually buy a clock off the shelf, and it will be a very nice reference for this. It's no problem. The experimental center of difficulty here is that the lines we're working are relatively broad because of the finite lifetime, and so you have to actually split the line a lot. But let me just show you some of the most recent results that we got with dysprosium. And Nate Leifer, who is here, is the lead of this work. So we, on the sort of this just uniform variation of alpha, we have limits sort of at the level of 10 to minus, pardon, 10 to the 16. Per year, but we, which is not the best limit, but a factor of a few away from the single ion clocks and so on. But we also, in the spirit of what you said, analyzed it not just as a uniform variation of alpha, but as you know, looking for correlation of alpha with the gravitational potential. As the Earth moves around the Sun, due to the eccentricity, the dimensionless gravitational potential that we see, which is about 10 to the minus 8 or so, varies by about a percent. So we have 10 to minus 10 variation of the gravitational potential. We can try to correlate alpha with that. And this number actually is presently the best limit. And I understand that this is not because our experiment is intrinsically the most sensitive, but because it's hard to get those fancy clock running for a long time without breaking or something like this. But I think eventually people will supersede this. So when this work was presented, actually at Nate's PhD qualifying exam, some clever guy asked a question. He said, "So you're talking about the gravitational potential of the sun, but we have gravitating objects that are closer, the moon and the earth, and you know we are standing on the earth, we are not falling towards the sun, luckily. Why? And so they got Nate to do a little calculation on the board to show that the gravitational potential is in fact much bigger from the sun, but the gradient of the gravitational potential is bigger from the earth. And then we started thinking about it already after Nate passed his exam with flying colors. What if we, for example, go to higher gradients? And if you consider the not just the gradient of the gravitational potential, which is small g, right, but the gradient of that, then you quickly discover that that falls like 1 over r cubed. And if you have a uniform density, the amount of mass in a sphere goes as r cubed. So the gradient is independent of the size of the object. And so if you want to go to higher gradients, you don't really win compared to the Earth, but you can compete with the Earth. And so we decided everybody lets their mind loose and thinks of exotic fields. We're trying to be sort of like Maxime and others, and we said, well, why don't we postulate ad hoc that there is some tensor field permeating the universe, maybe some tensor component of dark matter, and then let's say that alpha is in fact 1 plus a contraction of the gravitational gradient field with this cosmic tensor field. In fact, we set this up. So what you see here is the alpha dot apparatus, dysprosium alpha dot apparatus, and this is 600 pounds of lead in a bag. And this is mounted on a winch, and this is all very cool. You press a button and it goes up and down. So it looks like it's near the floor, but I want to tell you that it's not sitting on the floor. It's in fact suspended. Then we can press the button and lift it up in line with the apparatus. But at all times, it's suspended at one and the same point up there. So when you move up and down, you really do not bend the building, very much. We did a quick experiment. I think it was one day or something. We have a limit now on this tensor postulated ad hoc. I don't know, maybe it should be per parsec or something. I don't know. But in some numbers, is 10 to the 21, and that's an experimental limit, and this is just we can do much better. We can probably do a couple orders of magnitude better if you really tried. As I said, the gradient doesn't really depend on the size very much, so we can also wait for the Earth to rotate in the overall background gradient and get similar kinds of limits. But this brings up the first question that I would like to throw out here is, does this search actually make sense? What is this? Is such a background tensor allowed? And because of course, as Maxime mentioned, that I'm persistent, but he doesn't like to use the word annoying, but I've so with this particular problem, Peter can testify that once a week he gets an email from me reminding him to look at this problem. And actually, we have another collaborator, Mike Hohensey, he looked at this and he believes there are some constellations somehow. Very intrinsic to that this tensor should go away. But we also spoke with Victor Flambaum, and I think Peter and Victor sort of feel that there shouldn't be any consequences. Anyway, I just wanted to throw this out as the first question. Okay, so I have a number of questions. Let me see, how am I doing on time, Maxime?
Well, we postponed the coffee break to the original time, 11, so you have another 10.
Okay, so I have maybe time. I have time for another thing. Let's sort of put a separator here. So that was the first question I wanted to throw out. So now I'm going to throw an easy question to you, which is parity conserved in gravitation? And you know, some of us are professors here, others are TAs, and so we come very proud of ourselves in front of our students, and we always say, well, you know, all interactions that we know, they conserve parity except for the weak interaction that violates parity. We say that. Right? And once in a while, some clever student in the back would say, and how do we know, Professor, that parity is conserved by gravitational interaction? And in fact, I assume the role of this naive students and already some years ago, and I started bugging everybody with this question. And tell me if I'm wrong, but I have not seen any limits on parity violation in gravity actually put, except for Derek's experiment and the experiments of that type. I'll talk about those.
Parity or time reversal even, right?
Yeah.
Because the parity or time reversal odd.
I was just going to say.
Because you can't create a pseudoscalar out of this.
Ah, hold on, I can. Coming up, I can. Okay? So, and the second question is, how do we check? And I should say that this is a little bit like philosophical or something, and this comes up every few years, and then, you know, all kinds of phone calls and emails go out, and usually people are really annoyed about this. And how to check? Well, they say, well, you know, maybe you have to look at the, you know, left rotating planets and right rotating. It doesn't sound really practical. But actually, I myself can tell you that a very nice way to test parity in the weak interactions is to look for gravitational dipole moments. And I think, Mike, you're looking for those as well, correct?
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah, so Mike is looking for them. And of course, I hear more frequently about Derek's just because of proximity. But these gravitational dipole moments is just sigma dot g correlation. So they are perfectly p odd, but they're also t odd and also violate all kinds of other things. So okay. Anyway, one of the people whom I've been annoying about this question was the same Professor Hriplovich, you know, and he was he has written a book on gravitation, and of course he is, you know, one of the founding fathers of parity violation business, and he was really annoyed about these questions. He would answer very, you know, in a very like telegraphic way, like I would say, what do you think if we consider like tests of parity in gravitation interactions, and he would reply, it's not gonna work or something. but one of the questions that I posed, how would we test it? And in one of his very annoyed and brief emails, he said, well, if I were you, I would think about a centrifuge. And I thought about it, and I thought, This is brilliant. Okay, so what he's saying is, let's not give up the equivalence principle. Let's say that you know, the being in an accelerated frame is the same as gravity. We're not giving this up, and then we can do experiments in a centrifuge where we can control things. We don't have to have, you know, left rotating planets, right rotating. We have a centrifuge, and we can try to build this T even pivot correlation in centrifuge, and then it can do controlled experiment. So what is the correlation? Let's see. So what you have? You have presumably, again, the spin polarization. And then in the centrifuge, you have the angular velocity, and you have the radius vector where you put your test tube, right? And so if you want to build a T even pivot correlation, you this is the combination of letters. Very easy. Okay. That's let's just do a little theoretical physics here. So omega cross R is V, right? And so this is nothing but sigma V correlation. Fine. And then I'm thinking, wow, I can do more theoretical physics here. Let's let's multiply by M and divide by M. And then I get sigma P divided by M. So, and sigma P is this thing I asked you to remember from my first slide. It's the original parity violation correlation. And here I'm thinking, wow, wait a second. But why in centrifuge, when we have an atom with electron going around, why is not better than a centrifuge? And then the idea was born from this, that why don't we take the existing parity violation experiments in atoms and see if we can constrain gravity like this. And then another round of phone calls went out, and one of them was to Arkady Weinstein. And Arkady Weinstein told me that theoretically, it's impossible to put any kind of spin interaction in low order in gravity. And so anybody who is looking for either GDM or any kind of thing like this is not studying gravity, but in fact looking for some additional fields. And but he said, and in order to look for this additional field, in the words of Arkady Weinstein, you have to be bitten by a bug, you know. But he said there are a lot of people who are bitten by a bug, Maxime, and you know, and others. And you're clearly bitten by the bug, so you can do the experiment, but you don't say they are studying gravity. So, the question is, can you study test gravity via atomic parity violation? And you know, I can't actually judge this statement. I'm not educated enough in the physics of gravity, but according to Arkady, this is not the study of gravity. So maybe you can comment on this. But nevertheless, you know, my success is I also got Victor Flambaum and his crew here, and we'll have a whole talk about this, interested in this. And so we can look for parity violation that doesn't come from the interaction of the electron with the nucleus, but comes from interaction with some exotic cosmic fields. And of course, these are well motivated because we can be very proud and say that we understand everything. We don't need it because we don't understand most of the stuff. And I like to say that this story is like in that series of bad jokes where one thing leads to another. You know, it's not a test of parity. And gravity, apparently, but maybe something of value. And again, I think Valod, one of these gentlemen here is giving this talk. I think your talk?
Split.
Okay, good. So this is like sort of a historical introduction to how this whole business came about. And this is the paper you can find on the archive. And what particularly warms my heart here is that our zero parity violation result in dysprosium from 97 actually turns out to be you know, better than the limits from cesium and thallium on this exotic interaction. So all of a sudden that zero comes back to help us here. And you can also you know, do some limits from nuclear anapoles, but Evgeny will tell you better. This was supposed to be about open, I'm telling you a story, but it's supposed to be about open questions. The open question I would like to pose, and I think this is work in progress, in fact, is how do cosmic PNC searches fare compared to other searches? So they're also sensitive to some, you know, pseudo-vectors, pseudo-scalar fields, but there are other ways, like the Kasper and Nomi gnome experiment, and so how, And are there any unique capabilities in these experiments that other approaches do not have? We would like to know, because we can push these. We can really push these. But one of the things, by the way, is nobody said that the atoms that are good for parity, normal conventional parity evaluation, like cesium, for example, that it is good for this cosmic PNC, because you, for example, there's the requirement of electron being close to the nucleus is relaxed somewhat. So dysprosium is sensitive despite of the suppression of the normal PNC. Maybe so. Well, so we should discuss. So and okay. So being an annoying guy, I want to pose to everybody the original question. I would really like to know how to test parity violation in gravity, because Mark.
I have
yeah. But Mark is one of the guys whom we used to annoy. He spent a year at Berkeley, and we asked him a lot of questions. Yes, please.
So the Earth spins around, and there are these two satellites, the LIGO satellite, and one is on an inclined orbit going around this way, and the other is on an inclined orbit going around the other way. And there are some forms of gravitational parity violation that would give rise to the effect. It's hard to figure out how you do it with static fields, stationary fields. So if the Earth is spinning around, then that gives rise to a gravitomagnetic field. And that gravitomagnetic field allows you to construct more parity violating operators.
Well, it would be nice to kind of compile, I think, all possible tests into some table and with relative sensitivities and things like this. So, I mean,
the basic idea is that if instead of thinking about the gravitational field G, we think about the gravitomagnetic field that arises due to the motion of masses, then there might be effects.
So how does that compare to the gravity probe B experiment? I mean, is that the same kind of thing, or is that?
It actually does better than gravity probe B.
Oh. Okay.
Mark, just for concreteness, is there a term, some higher derivative term in general relativity you could write down that is violates parity, or?
You can write down. There are two ways that people do it. One is the Chern-Simons term. So you add the gravitational Lagrangian. Are dual, but then that makes gravity a higher derivative theory, and that bothers some people, that bother other people.
Sure.
And the other thing is, people here wrote papers about there's something called the Holst action for gravity. So in gravity, you have a spin 2 field. We usually write the action as the Einstein-Hilbert action R, but when you go to this spinner formula. There's actually a way of writing the Einstein-Hilbert action as a right-handed part and a left-handed part. And the Einstein-Hilbert action, both parts are equal, but you can actually weight those two parts slightly differently. That also gives you a gravitational parity violation without changing the lowest order predictions of GR that objects move along to those, et cetera.
And it's equivalent to the Chern-Simons thing?
No, I think it's different.
Okay, guys, I have a proposal. So this was supposed to be a part with the questions and the answers. Let's have some special time. But this is like of burning interest. So I think we should we have some time for these things, right?
Don't want to stand on the day without.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's just hold the thought, please, and let's discuss further. But I guess I have another 5 minutes. Then I can actually finish my talk, I believe. So the next part has to do about searching exotic physics with antimatter, and I should confess that this has sort of an institutional reason. I'm at the Helmholtz Institute Mainz. I'm the leader of a section, yes, that's called matter-antimatter asymmetry. And so I have to, by my mandate, think about these things, and I am. So. I should say that we have recently entered a new era in antimatter physics, where we can actually do spectroscopy with matter. This is a beautiful experiment done by the Alpha Collaboration already a couple years ago, where they basically are looking at the microwave transition in hydrogen. So now we can do spectroscopy with antimatter. And now a lot of people now are excited about this, and they say, let's test fundamental physics. But somehow the sort of the range of imagination that people have strikes me as a little bit limited. Most people are studying whether antimatter would fall up or fall down, you know. But say that eventually when we have a lot of atoms, we can do 1s2s transition in hydrogen. But the question is, can you have some other exotic physics to test? And this was never suggested what? Yeah. So this was one other item of annoyance, and all these people they basically say that okay, it is actually difficult to come up with a scenario that will have exotic physics with antimatter that would not leak into ordinary matter without some serious fine tuning. So basically, the tests of exotic physics with normal matter are just as good as with antimatter. And this is a very happy joint chorus of theorists who say that.
There are important experiments done with spectroscopy of antimatter, not the standard one, like helium-4 antiproton electron, right? This is a series of very important measures.
And of course, there are equivalence principle tests that have some virtual antimatter content. So we're doing this. But the question.
Some virtual. 99% of the test body is virtual. So the mass of the nucleons is all glued, anti-glued.
Yeah.
So if there's some antiparticle and it doesn't. So if there is a vector component to gravity and antimatter falls up, all this glue, anti-glue would be gravitationally inert.
Yeah. But people say, well, this is not free antimatter. Maybe there is. I mean, that's a question. I don't know. But of course, this is a valid physics argument. But the question is there something we are missing? Let's not like have it like a framework that we can look out of. And at least we can ask the question. Anyway, it was a couple of years ago. I thought, let me just Google and see, what the status of the debate about antimatter is in the literature. And I take no stake in what I'm going to show you because it was literally a result of 5 minute Googling. So I Google and I find a paper by Wally Greenberg that says that. CPT doesn't imply Lorentz invariance. Okay, then I Google some more, and there is a paper by Sasha Dolgov that says that Wally said that CPT does imply violation of CPT, sorry, got it wrong. Violation of CPT does imply violation of Lorentz invariance. Then there is another paper by similarly clever people that says that violation of CPT does not require violation of Lorentz invariance. And then there is a further paper by the same guy says that even though violation of CPT does not imply violation of Lorentz invariance, Lorentz invariance still ensures that mass of the particle and antiparticle should be the same, even if there is CPT. So there I found, at least in the literature, some lively debates going on. So my personal opinion. If we have antimatter, we shouldn't pay attention to what theorists or astronomers say, but measure sort of what we feel ourselves is important. But what could this be? I think we can just look at what we do with normal matter tests and try to do them with antimatter as well. Dependence of things, clock transitions or whatever on gravitational potential and gradients, anomalous spin mass and spin coupling, maybe noise correlation in the network, some of the clocks being anti-clocks, and temporal violation. And when we do this, we should remember, of course, that many, if not most, specific models will be already constrained by experiments with ordinary matter, positrons, and antiprotons. And so one thought I would like to say is that everybody's talking about anti-hydrogen, but you don't have to stop at that. You can look at more complex system. And listening to conservative radio, I discovered that there is actually a whole anti-energy secretary, in fact. Sorry. So the question that I'd like to pose is, what tests should be done with antimatter sort of beyond antimatter falling up experiments? And I think it's an interesting general question here. Okay, so I think I should stop here because it's time for coffee. I just want to say that I do have some list of now one level down, specific questions to Noam and Casper, but we haven't heard about Casper yet, so maybe this should be postponed till later time. And I think, so this is really this is related to these questions. Okay, thanks.